Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of September 28th, 2015. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, Mr. D.R. Tucker. And how are you doing today, D.R.?
Good, how are you doing?
Very well, very well. None of our listeners can see you, but I can see you on Skype, and you look very debonair, as always.
Thanks.
So
Thanks.
Glad to have you here. So, DR, this has been another impressive week in the breadth of news and variety of news, right? Lots and lots of stuff going on. Here in Massachusetts, there was a report splashed all over the front page of the Globe, Boston Globe, but it has relevance, I think, across the country and across the world, is that a nuclear power plant called the Pilgrim Nuclear Plant, which is just south of Boston, is being rated by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission as one of, if not the, but very close to the bottom of the list of safe nuclear plants, right? Mm-hmm. And the owners have said, boy, if it costs too much to make this plant workable, we're just going to shut it down, right? Mm-hmm. Did you see that article?
Yes, yes, they appear to be going nuclear, so to speak. The owners of the plant have basically determined that if they find that the cost of making the improvements of the plant exceed the plant's value, they'll decide just to simply pull the plug on the plant. But they're saying that as of now, they don't know the costs. They also note that the Globe also notes that the plant could be shut down by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Because obviously, you know, we don't want another.
It's not safe.
We don't need, you know, 4 Mile Island, so to speak, right. or going all the way to the China syndrome, if you will.
Yeah, and, I mean, it's interesting that the owners are concerned about, you know, what's the cost of keeping it open? Can they run it? Whereas everyone who's sitting around it, looking at it, saying, boy, I hope it doesn't have some sort of a radiation release.
Exactly.
But I guess so. What is the take-home lesson for climate hawks of the shutdown, sort of the surprise shutdown of a nuclear plant that had, you know, especially given the fact that, given what the role that nuclear plays in the thinking of many climate activists of goodwill who see nuclear as a way to go forward?
Well, it shows you that it's a conflict of visions because Jim Hansen, the former NASA scientist, has been a zealous advocate for the past couple of years about nuclear power being, you know, the sine qua non of you know, clean power. Mm-hmm. And you also hear some people who used to be vocal about the need to take action on climate change, such as Senator John McCain. And Senator Lindsey Graham also saying that, and Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee also saying that nuclear has to play a critical role, and suggesting that nuclear is safer than ever. And then you see these reports, and you remember Fukushima, and then you think that maybe nuclear is not exactly as safe as it might be. And I had a chance to watch the China Syndrome a couple of years ago. That was one hell of a movie about a potential hell, if you get my drift.
Well, I think for me the lesson I took out of it was that even. It's actually a couple lessons, but one is, even though you have this massive plant, you know, billions of dollars put into it, it still goes offline occasionally. This summer they had to turn down the power because the cooling water they're taking out of Massachusetts Bay was too hot to cool the nuclear reactor. And the reason that I harp on that is because the big complaint about wind turbines and solar panels is that they're intermittent, right? The sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. But even these massive plants don't have a perfect record of delivering power 100% of the time.
Exactly.
And the other sort of big take-home lesson that I see from this kind of thing is more conceptual than anything else. But a nuclear plant like the Pilgrim plant is the epitome of centralized power production, right? It's an enormous, incredibly expensive, localized plant that generates an awful lot of electricity, which then has to go out over lines to faraway places. So that's part of a centralized power plant model of generating electricity. And just there's a different way to think about it, is to say there are solar panels spread across the country, across the state, wind turbines everywhere, people are generating their energy locally, right? And that, it seems to me, is a very appealing model. So you have a centralized model, a decentralized model, a distributed energy model. It's just much less likely, it seems more reliable, that while you have many small installations, some of them may not be working, but most of them will be working most of the time, right?
Exactly. And you don't have to worry about solar or wind affecting your health, despite what the conspiracy theorists say about, you know, about clean energy and that fake wind turbine syndrome nonsense. You know?
Right.
Whereas with nuclear, if something goes wrong,
something goes very, very wrong. Yeah. So I mean, it's just an interesting case study, an opportunity to talk about this distributed versus localized. And of course, this then rewinds to our friend Dave Roberts' critique of the utility business model, because the utilities are all based on building these enormous capital-intensive nuclear or coal or natural gas plants. They don't make as much money when the power is distributed around, right?
So, if you think about, is there not a great comparison between these utilities and the movie theater chains that are losing business to video on demand? Is it not simply the same thing, that people are basically controlling things for themselves, that they don't need to go to a movie theater or they don't need to go to a big utility? They can do their own thing. It's literally do-it-yourself film watching, do-it-yourself energy.
Basically. I think that's a perfect analogy, right? Because the business model of the movie theater is broken. Right. Mm-hmm. There's new technology and people don't need to go to the moon. Same thing in the energy industry. So so anyway, there's that. And then we're going to stay in a Massachusetts context. But again, it's I think it has wider lessons. The governor, of course, and we talked about this last week, is trying to arrange to bring in hydroelectric power generated at a plant up in Quebec called Hydro-Québec to pipe that relatively clean energy, no doubt about it. I mean, it's relatively green, clean power from a climate perspective, down into the Massachusetts region. And some analysis suggests that 30% of the power for the entire state of Massachusetts will be bought at roughly 18 cents a kilowatt hour. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason that that's important is because 6 months ago, when Cape Wind bit the dust, so to speak, the big complaint was that the power from Cape Wind was going to be about 18 cents a kilowatt hour. Right? So here we are back now, 6 months later. We could have built Cape Wind if anyone in the Massachusetts government had gone to bat for it. Right?
Exactly.
But now we're going to send. And what's really frustrating is that 18 cents a kilowatt hour is all going to go out of Massachusetts and go up to Hydro-Québec. So instead of generating jobs here, Massachusetts, the last count I saw, it said Massachusetts exports $20 billion a year to buy energy, because we have no energy in the state. If we could keep that $20 billion here in Massachusetts, what an economic boon it would be. Right?
Exactly. And it just goes to show you know, why this fixation? Why is there this fixation of trying to get energy from out of state when you can make your own clean energy right here in the state? Why do you want imported energy when you can have it domestic? It makes no sense at all.
Right. I mean, you know, your lips to God's ears. I mean, or the governor's ears. Who knows? So there's those two things. And then you get to the really juicy items that came up this week. I don't know what order we ought to talk about them, but they're related, right? So last week we talked about the discovery that Exxon Corporation knew as early as 1977 that climate change was, that their product was causing climate change, which puts them right up there in a class with all the tobacco executives over the decades. But the other amazing fact, which has relevance to climate hawks, is that the Volkswagen Corporation, right, the Farfignugen guys, deliberately are cheating on their emission control. So, DR, I'll leave it to you. Which one do we talk about first? I mean, they're both
Well,
so amazing that I can't even figure out which one to go at first.
I think they should both be combined because it just shows you what happens, the consequences of greed basically causing sort of malfeasance. In Volkswagen's case, the malfeasance of trying to put of putting software on to sort of fool emissions testing for nitrous oxide, which can
So,
cause respiratory ailments,
right.
and also Exxon engaging in the malfeasance of hiding their own research and then trying to pretend their own research was fake. And how interesting is it that now there's talk about fines and Volkswagen being held legally accountable, something to the tune of 18 billion, while at the same time there is a grassroots effort by, among others, the group Climate Hawks Vote, to have the Justice Department prosecute ExxonMobil under RICO statutes, the same way that the tobacco industry was, the same way Michael Milken was, for their own deliberate lying and sort of tricking and hoodwinking the American public and putting out false information to deceive people and damage the public health.
So,
In both
DR,
cases,
I got to jump in. Wait, I just want to, so we don't lose anybody. So, what VW did, right? VW consciously, they got their smartest engineers in the room and told them to figure out when is their diesel car being tested for emissions reasons, right? And
Yes.
what they figured out is that, okay, if the wheels are going exactly constant speed, right? Because the way the EPA does, they put it up on a test stand and the wheels roll on other wheels, kind of like a bearing. So the car's up on a table, the wheels are spinning, but it's perfectly constant speed, and the steering wheel never turns at all because no one's driving. The computer says, ah, I'm undergoing an emissions test. I'm going to change the catalytic converter or something so that I can pass the test. And once the speed of the wheel starts to go up and down and the steering wheel changes direction, they say, oh, okay, we're back to, we're going to drive the old-fashioned way, which put out something like 40 times more nitrous oxide than it did during the test. And this
Exactly.
was consciously and deliberately planned by VW, which I just, and to what you're saying, they're on the hook now for something like $37,000 a car. When you
Yes.
multiply it out, it's $18 billion, and they made $4 billion last year.
Exactly.
So they're in deep, deep doo-doo.
And the CEO of Martin, CEO of Volkswagen, Martin Winterkorn, has resigned as a result of the scandal. I guess you can say that he was bugging out, so to speak.
But I mean, I think that for climate organizations, do we need to be continuously challenging the test? I mean, can you? So suppose some we have the president's climate plan, right? The company, coal company XYZ are running a power plant. It says, oh, trust me, yeah, I measured it. It's all good. There's only a little bit of CO2 coming up my chimney. Do you believe them anymore? I mean, how do you? It just raises this whole specter of deliberate deception in these critically important carbon dioxide emissions tests that will be coming over the next few years. I don't know. It's something that we got to start watching for.
And it's also fascinating, and it goes to the issue that Naomi Klein raised in her book, This Changes Everything, about, the private sector and whether or not the private sector has credibility when it says it's going to take action to reduce emissions. It's interesting that all this controversy over VW and Exxon comes the same week that some major companies such as Nike, Walmart, Goldman Sachs, Johnson and Johnson, Procter and Gamble, Salesforce, Starbucks, and Voya Financial committed themselves to transition to 100% clean energy. And you can say on the one hand, it's nice to see all these major companies saying we're going to transition to clean energy, but on the other hand, you remember Volkswagen suggesting that their cars were clean. You have ExxonMobil suggesting dubiously that they support a revenue neutral carbon taxation, and it's like, who can you trust? It's like the old Ronald Reagan line, trust but verify, basically. And it's nice to see that. And it should be noted, there's some misreporting saying that it was the EPA that initially did the catching of Volkswagen. It was actually a third-party private entity run by former EPA officials. I believe it's called the International Consortium for Clean Transportation that discovered this flaw, well, this intentional flaw.
Not a flaw. It's a design feature.
and then informed the EPA, and then the EPA took action. So it also goes to show, number one, it shows you a number of things. One, number one, the importance of the EPA when you hear all the demagoguery of the EPA. Number two, the importance of third-party entities that try to, you know, bolster environmental protection. Mm-hmm. And number three, it also shows you that, again, when it comes to private sector claims that they're going to take action on climate change and clean energy and emissions, trust but verify.
Right. I think the EPA, they've been sort of burned here, and I think they're going to go after heads. They're going to make sure that their stuff gets enforced going forward. Mm-hmm. Anyway, exactly. Yeah, we got to leave it there. It's fascinating stuff. I'll remind everyone that just on September 29th, which should be Tuesday, September 29th, there is a hearing at the State House for you to go and participate. There'll be people providing information to your elected representatives about the Hydro-Quebec bill that we've spoken about frequently and the solar caps bill. You can sign up through MCAN. We'll put up a link to the page to go and participate. There's also on October 14th coming up, the 350 group is soliciting people to set up their own kind of personal demonstrations in their towns in support of climate action. Check it out. We'll put a link up. So, DR, we'll put the links to most of what we talked about on the blog. The blog is at massclimateaction.net/blog. Please go there, leave a comment. You can find this show and the links to the blog on our Facebook page. It's at /massclimateaction. Please share us with your friends. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher or TuneIn Radio. You can find us on iTunes by searching for Massachusetts Climate Action. Of course, if you subscribe there, it's a good thing. It helps our visibility within the iTunes universe. So we'll close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. Thank you very much for being here, DR.
Thanks.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.